square up the New York way, where the people are so gay, twisting the night away. Here they have a lot of fun, putting trouble on the run. Man, you find the old and young, twisting the night away. They're twisting, twisting, everybody's feeling great. They're twisting, twisting, they're twisting the night away. Here's a man in evening clothes. How he got here, I don't know. But man, you ought to see him go twisting the night away. He's dancing with the chicken slacks.
Okay, hi guys, welcome back. This is Melissa Peskin, OBGYN, Pearls of Wisdom. I'm so excited today to have Doctors Judy Levy and Nancy Levine with me. We've known each other a while, but certainly I am very happy and proud to say that Judy is my, or was my OB. And Nancy, a good friend, was my actually colleague. They have a very unique perspective on their time at Montefiore. And so I'm really excited to dive in today and hear everything they have to say. So without further ado, I just want to ask you, I'm going to ask you what year you went to, you were at Einstein, and like how long you were there and what you did with your career in just like a nutshell and what you're doing now. And then we'll sort of dive in, to the question part. You want to start, Judy Levy?
age before beauty. And I am older. So I started at medical school at Einstein in 1977, graduated in 1981, finished my residency at what was that actually then called Bronx Municipal Hospital Center in 1985. And then I took a job there, and I stayed, and I was mostly happily ever after until I retired in 2020.
That was a big year.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And you delivered a lot of babies.
I delivered a lot of babies.
Including mine, both of them.
I did. And had many, many wonderful patients and wonderful people that I worked with, which is why I stayed so long when sometimes the going got tough. But I stayed.
Well, I'm interested in exploring when the going got tough, because it actually understanding the natural history of the program, the hospital, certainly leads up and gives a lot of context to how it was for me, and certainly how it is for the current residents. So it'll be really great to hear. Okay.
Nancy.
Okay, so I started medical school in 1983, August 19th, 1983, my last cigarette. And just coincidentally, my next door neighbor when I was in medical school was Judy.
No.
But she was a resident, so I didn't really know her. I knew her first husband. But literally, we were next door neighbors.
Wow.
Flash forward, I did residency from 87 to 91. I did a pelvic surgery fellowship at Einstein, which was really a year of GYN oncology until 92. And then I went off to Northwestern for the next 5 years and then came back to Einstein when I began to work with Judy. And we were in something called Faculty 2, which was a private practice model, but we were faculty, but we operated in a private practice model. There are five women on OBGYN, and we backed up midwives.
Faculty 2 / the women's group.
Right. I knew you as the women's group.
Right. But we did that, and I loved it until somewhere around 2012 when the world began to change. And our departmental chair and OB departmental chair didn't want to support us anymore, really. They wanted us to be less like a private practice and more like hospital-based. We always used to know our patients, and we would come in every, we would work every, right. We were on call every fifth night, and we would not residents wouldn't touch our patients because we were there. And the
Right.
administration didn't like that so much. They wanted us to do more of the sharing the burden of all patients and less private attention.
Well, I don't think it was that they didn't like what we did. They didn't want to pay us for what we did.
Right. I was just
Well,
going to
that's
say, I
not
think it's
my,
about the
that's the
bottom
same
line.
thing.
Yeah,
Yeah, because they didn't value what we did.
Yes.
Well, I think,
They didn't.
I mean, the bottom line is what governs most hospital systems now, unfortunately. And
It's
I'm
money.
seeing that, yeah.
Money. Money. I
I'm
don't
seeing
think they
that.
valued us.
No, I mean,
Cheap.
I
I
think,
don't.
well, right, of the hospital specifically said, you are replaceable to my face. And that was extremely hurtful. And I disagree wholeheartedly. I think each and every one of us brings a unique gift to the field, and I don't think each of us are replaceable. And to have that as his a philosophy is really
Dehumanizing.
yeah, dehumanizing. It's malignant, and it's wrong, I think. Anyway. Ugh.
Well, I do think that it started before 2012, and kind of we had a complicated chairman, a very complicated chairman who came to the program when I was still a resident. So he was my chairman virtually forever till the bad ending when I left. But
No, she
he
came.
left. She came. He was there for only 33 of your 40 years there.
Okay. I think I might have been 34, but in any case, what I have to point out is there was a combination of one of the reasons that I didn't join a private practice when I finished residency was that I saw how private practitioners worked. I knew I wanted to have children very soon. I wanted a little more flexibility. And at that time in 1985, he was willing to support that, and he was willing to give flexible time. I had a day off a week. I only worked 4 days a week when I started working in 1985. Now, my salary was
Right.
commensurate with that, commensurate. And the problem was I valued my time, but then as the years went on and on and on, it was clear he was, paying the men more than he was paying the women, even if you were working commensurate hours.
Wait,
So,
and wait. And straight men more than gay men.
right. So, I mean, and that's where the transparency came later. I mean, I do think that there was some value in, after he left, really sort of shining a light, a spotlight on all of that, for all of the bad things that happened. That was one thing that I guess became a little more equitable. However, I suspect that he took advantage of you and all those women who were hardworking and devoted your life to the field, and were working mothers. I mean, what was that like back then? I mean, you were not the majority, right? Women were the minority? No. What was the ratio?
Well, in the residency program, actually, there was a time when I was a resident where the women outnumbered the men in
Oh.
residency. And that was due to Harold Shulman, actually, who was the chairman before Erwin Mercatz. Then he kind of eventually it turned back into there were a lot of men in the program. I'm not sure about Nancy's year, but he again he gave us maternity leave, which of a lot of places we got 3 months of paid maternity leave when I had my kids back in 86 and 89. So there were things that he was doing. He was willing to support women, but just sort of not in the same. There were men at the time who were also making I forget what how you would they were getting paid for productivity, like for how much surgery or how many deliveries. We never got paid like that. We were on a straight salary, and my salary kind of stagnated for many, many years at the end of my career. But at that point, I was happy doing what I did, and then I was working part time, so that was okay. But I was feeling not happy about a lot of things, I think. I mean, Nancy came and started your job like in 97. Nancy, is that about when you
I
came?
came back in 97,
So that
and
was
at that,
12 years after I
right.
got my first job, and I am not sure what negotiations at that point were like with him. But there was no
Well, he was
standard. There was no standard. Everybody
not
had
only
a
wait,
different
but
deal.
not only that, he would say to you, "Now, shh, this is a special deal I'm making with you, and don't talk money with any of your friends."
Sounds like someone who might be like,
Right.
president of the United States now.
Right. It does sound
Right.
familiar. I was thinking the same thing.
And as women, having been brought up in the era we were not trained to deal with money and negotiating about money. And here he was, the older doctor, the older daddy figure, which for me was not such a great model to begin with. And he's saying this to you. He was intimidating in a way. And he would sit you down on that ridiculously low down
Low down
couch
couch.
in his, and then he. You're facing the sun, it's in your eyes, and he's sitting in a regal chair in front of you, telling you, shh, don't tell your salary. You were scared
I
shitless.
was always afraid I was going to say the wrong thing, and I always did. So, it
Yes,
was whatever I said
yes,
was not the right thing. I may
yes.
have once, not may have, I did. I actually, and then regretted it for the next 15 or 20 years. I don't know, but I made a comment like, my time is worth more to me than money. That was like the kiss of death.
Right.
So, and in a way, it was right. I mean, that I wanted to have time to spend with my kids, but yeah, then
I
my
mean,
salary reflected that.
this,
So,
but this is like a novel idea. Well, you should be able to have both. You're a accredited MD who saves lives on a daily basis. You should be able to have both. You should be able to have time with your family, and you should be paid for the work that you do, commensurate with the work that you do, and e on equal footing as people of the opposite sex. I mean, when I was coming up from before I even started medical school, I worked for an orthopedic surgeon, and I used to go to these conferences with all these men, and they would, throw comments around. And I remember this one orthopedic surgeon from Wayne State. I'll never forget it. He was like, he said, women only give half of their professional life to the career, so they don't deserve to be paid anywhere near what men deserve to be paid, because
why
they
do they
spent
say
half their
half?
life, they half their career having babies. And I was just like, excuse me? I mean, how are you? How is that
That
even coming out of your mouth?
depends on how many babies you have, I think, but
But it doesn't even matter, because when you're working, you're working.
I remember him telling one MFM fellow who was Orthodox with four children that he got the woman who was single in the same year of fellowship, that she was getting less because he had four children and a wife that didn't work and she wasn't married. And he actually said that to her. But the thing that's interesting is less that he said that is that it was accepted. I mean, a lot of this stuff and a lot of the stuff before the Me Too movement, you just accepted and moved on with. And it probably really wasn't until Makeisha came in 2015 and the whole salary structure got blown open that we understood the extent of it.
Yeah, because even when he graduated and took the job, he took the job with another one of a female resident who had just graduated. So they literally started at the exact same
Who?
time. They had the exact same job, and he got significantly more money than she did, which made zero sense because they literally had the exact same job. The only major difference at the time was he had two kids, but so what? They are doing the same thing. I mean, it made no sense.
But she didn't leave.
Well, she eventually did, and she went to
No,
actually,
no.
oh,
I know, but my
no,
point
right.
is
Yeah.
when this
No,
was
she
happening,
didn't.
whether it was from lack of knowledge and the opaque
Sure,
status,
right.
but also we were used to we were used to this. We had gotten come up a system that was highly patriarchal in many, many ways.
Right. What was that like when you were in residency? I mean, did you feel the, for lack of a better word, like patriarchy? Like, did you feel sexism in your residency? Even if you, like, what was that? I mean, listen, I have no understanding. I was, not to date myself entirely or you,
Go
but I
ahead.
was in elementary school when you started residency. So,
Oh, great.
yeah,
Okay. What year did you start residency?
2008.
Wasn't that just
I
yesterday?
graduated, actually, when you came back to Montefiore, I was just thinking I graduated high school. So, yep.
Okay,
I
yeah.
don't think that I at least was as conscious of financials between men and women as a resident. What I think I remember most about the residency was the Me Too stuff.
No, I agree with Nancy. When you were saying patriarchal, I mean, the thing about residency is the PGY1s make this much money, and PGY2s, there's no, there's a pay scale, and it doesn't matter if you're male or female. But in terms of how we were treated, I would say, not among my, co-residents at all. And as I said, I started out with a class of 11 people, eight of whom were female, three men and eight women. And by the second year, we were seven women and two men. And that's how we went through residency. But there were attendings who were definitely, I mean, it was 1981, 82. These people had been in practice since the 60s, whatever. And they definitely had a different mindset.
Can you take me, because I certainly don't, can you take me through a day in the life of your, what your residency day looked like? Let's say you were on the labor floor or something, like what time you had to come in. Do you remember like writing notes? I
Oh,
mean, you
now
didn't have
you're
electronic fetal monitoring.
really stretching.
Whoa,
Yes,
wait. We did have electronic fetal
we
monitoring.
did not have ultrasounds, but
But
we had
it
electric.
wasn't centrally located.
No. You had to go in the room. You had to go in the room to
Okay,
see.
so take me through a day in the life.
Can I just say
What?
something? You had
Yeah.
to go to the room at Einstein. By the time I had was at, got to Northwestern, they had had telemetry for a
Oh,
long, long
okay. But
time.
you were finished. I mean, you were finished
No, but
residency.
I'm saying it's also not
For
to be
where you
lost in this
were.
conversation. Montefiore is not a ritzy, wealthy white hospital.
No.
Well, again,
Even when it was a solid middle class, it was
yes.
not a New York hospital ever.
When I started my residency in 1981, Albert Einstein Hospital, which at that point was not owned by Montefiore, it was owned by Einstein Yeshiva University, was a community hospital with no emergency room and no central monitoring, but we did have fetal monitors. I was just discussing with somebody the other day about what time we actually had to start. We in the realm of surgical residencies, maybe we never had to be in before 7 o'clock, but it also depended. We had four hospitals. We had three labor floors and four GYN services. So it did kind of depend on what hospital you were in and who your chief was. But I would say the more memorable services, Jacoby OB always started the day at 7 a.m. And we'd round with the residents who were there. We'd get the sign out from the night, but then an attending would come and make rounds with us on the labor floor. And of course, all the notes were handwritten. We spun our own hematocrits sometimes on the labor floor because you sent labs to the lab. And at the labs, at the end of the day, you had to go down to the lab, and on the walls out, I feel like I'm saying we had no TVs or telephones. We had to go down to the lab, and outside the wall of the lab, they print all the, so you had to copy it down, Levy, sodium, potassium, to copy everything down. Would have been nice if we could have taken pictures with our phone, but we had to copy everything down. So we did Gram stains? Didn't we do Gram stains? Oh, we did Gram stains and hematocrits and like looked at urine. We did a lot of stuff on the labor floor at Jacoby.
Also, as HIV is hitting, we're
Yes.
doing all of this without gloves.
Well, a lot of it without gloves, yeah.
Wow.
But
And was that really bad in the Bronx at that time?
Well, by Nancy's residency, I started residency in 81, not in, I mean, around 1983. So, I mean, I was a junior, I was a third year resident by then that people started talking about this thing, and wasn't so much with heterosexual women, which is mostly,
Right,
what
what you're
we were
seeing.
dealing with it yet. But certainly by the time I became an attending in 85 and 86, it was horrendous. But and I mean, we were on every third night during residency. So, 4 years of every third night, which was pretty hard. So it was 7 a.m. Technically, sign out was at 5 p.m. So maybe you'd leave at 6. So it was like an 11-hour day, I guess. Or the other way around.
Or
So
35.
wait. Oh yeah, I almost forgot. Ha ha.
We
We didn't.
spent
If
36
you were
hours
on
on the labor
call,
floor.
then you were on call until 5, 7 a.m. one day till 5 o'clock the next day. So, and we did
What?
that. And we did that every third.
Wait, what?
Well, no, we did it Tuesday, Friday, Sunday, Saturday, Wednesday, had the weekend off.
Wait, what?
Yeah,
How
you
is
did, right?
that possible?
It is possible. What do you mean?
That's
How's
like
it?
150 hours a week. Yes.
110.
Yeah, it's like
We worked
100.
110. But we had full weekends off. I mean, there was something delicious about you left the labor floor at 5 o'clock on Friday and you didn't have to be there till 7 o'clock on Monday.
Well, I beg to differ. You started your residency after I did. When I did residency, you were on every third night. So you were either on,
You
well,
didn't sw
no,
No, you did.
we did Friday,
Friday,
Sunday, or
Sunday.
Saturday. Friday, Sunday, or Saturday. We
Yeah,
never.
no, of course, you did Friday or Sunday, and then you had to do
No,
like
no, no, no,
Thursday.
no, no, no. No, we did Friday, Sunday, or Saturday.
I know,
Those
but
were
during the
your
week, you had
saying.
another call. That's your weekend.
We did not have a Friday, Saturday, Sunday off.
No, I'm sorry. You had a Friday, Sunday, Thursday, Monday, Saturday, Tuesday. Weekend off. That's how you got all the wait days of the week. When you did Friday, Sunday, you still had to have another night during the week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Tuesday or Wednesday?
I know, but that's what I'm saying. But they did do it in a way
Okay.
so
We
you.
shouldn't, we don't have to, we don't have
Anyway,
to,
I
I
know, but I
mean,
always feel sorry for residents nowadays because they don't have an entire weekend off ever.
I didn't either. So
Yes, you did. You did.
we had a golden weekend every like 8 weeks or so. That was a
We
very
had it every
exciting.
third week.
Okay.
But what you did to achieve it was so sick.
Well, because you didn't have night float, you had
No.
call.
No, we didn't have night float. And even though people say that's better, I watched my son go through night float during his residency. Not in his primary residency, but when he did other stuff, like he had to do some general surgery and some other stuff. When he did night float, I don't know. I'm not a good day sleeper. I don't know how I would have done that for long periods of time.
Anyway.
Night float
So.
was terrible, and night float is like if you don't sleep from 9 to 4, you're screwed. And then if you're on for like 6 weeks straight, you have to do things. There are things that you have to do during the day that you can't
Right.
need to do, and so you're like sacrificing your sleep. And there's no sleeping on
But
call.
there was no consciousness of irregular sleep hours being bad for your emotional, psychological, and physical health. That did not exist as a
No. Right.
consciousness in society.
Right.
Now, sleep has taken on a priority in all wellness regimens that did not exist.
Right. I mean, even nowadays, I don't have a, my circadian rhythms are completely messed up as a hospitalist. I work all different types of shifts. So sometimes a 24, sometimes just nights, sometimes just day. And I have terrible sleep. And my mom has Alzheimer's, and I'm terrified that this is going to be the nail in the coffin for me because while this is nice that I get to spend all this time with my children, my sleep is suffering. And I'm capable of doing it because of what residency was like. I'm trained to basically operate at any hour of the day, night, no matter what the emergency. But I don't know what toll that's going to take. You'll have to follow me in 20 years.
Or maybe not. Maybe this is the phase you need to do to make your life work right now, and you'll find the next phase when your kids are a little older.
Okay, fair. And then I can sleep, maybe. But by
You know
that,
that,
I just
yeah.
have to eat a lot of eggs, I think. I heard that eggs have choline, and choline is good for staving off amyloid deposits. I don't know what you've heard, but I'm don't dispel dispel that myth.
Blueberries and almonds,
Oh, blueberries,
fish oil,
almonds, and eggs.
and fish, yeah, are good for
And
you.
flaxseed and
Stuff.
anyway, tell me more. What was it? So, like, okay, so you're on call 36 hours. What is that like? I mean, the acuity of the Einstein that I know, that would be utterly impossible. And you guys have experienced that as attendings. So what was it like back then in terms of
During the
choline
course of my
acuity?
residency, things changed. When
Okay.
I started residency, Einstein was a middle class hospital. It was private, but it was middle class. It was not like New York Hospital. It was not like Northwestern. It changed because of
Wasn't as
something.
busy. Wasn't
It
as
wasn't a
busy.
visit. We used to say you'd go to Einstein's, you'd go to the beach. We would sunbathe on the roof. It was, and as interns, we were not even allowed to really do anything in Einstein because there were private practitioners who didn't want an
Yeah, you
intern.
didn't go to the labor floor until you were a second year at Einstein.
And it was so easy. We would go summit. But by the end of the residency, Mercatz, in his inimitable way, had made more contracts with HIP. And suddenly it got really, really busy, and the volume was incredible. But the doctors taking care of the volume were not necessarily the most thorough doctors. So residency at Einstein became much, much more difficult. And
Also, did
Einstein.
you have they built the emergency room when you
No,
started?
when we started, the emergency room was called the health closet because it
What?
was
Health.
one, it was literally like a one bedroom suite. And it was nothing. And then at some point when I was a young attending, they built the emergency room. The emergency room became the zoo that we now know it to be. And
And so
Einstein as a hospital became less of a private community hospital and more of a, if not a public hospital, a completely managed care hospital.
sure.
Managed care came in dramatically and changed things dramatically in the 90s.
Plus, even the GYN, the OB was not that difficult. In the GYN, there was no night stuff going on. If you don't have an ER, you don't get ectopics. But then as soon as the ER opened, then there were ectopics and missed ABs and all kinds of other stuff would come in. So yeah, it became busier and busier.
And
And
I want to hear how Jacoby factored into that, only because that's the only other. I mean, I worked at Moses and Jacoby and Weiler. So I'm
you never did NCB?
no, we didn't have NCB.
Oh, that was another
We
zoo.
talked about NCB closing their doors to us as we're banging on the doors to get in with the Moses OB patient, and they're being like, "Nope, sorry, we're closed. You're not allowed."
Yeah. That was an interesting hospital. The labor floor being run by midwives, really, which
Angry separatist, radical feminist, angry hate doctor midwives, as opposed to our midwives who were lovely, who were crunchy granola, and you could have a
Well,
right?
yes, I would say,
Was it
back
just
the NCB midwives, good and bad. I mean, good and bad,
well,
right?
even some of them were better doctors or midwives than other, but all of them had an attitude.
The
It
problem
was
was they also didn't have good doctors being
no.
backup for them. So
No.
that created a problem. But when I started my residency, Jacoby labor floor, very, very busy. Jacoby GYN, very busy. Einstein GYN, tons of hysterectomies and, regular daytime GYN stuff. Montefiore's GYN was pretty busy also. And NCB had OB, but like no GYN. There was like nothing there. And then, I mean, that it pretty much stayed the same over the course of my residency. But what changed eventually, as we said, the emergency room at Einstein changed the whole tenor of the hospital.
The other thing that changed when you started, things like hysterectomies were open and people would come in the night before for their surgery the next day.
Oh, right.
And then laparoscopy and oloscopies came in.
That's what I
And
wanted to
that
ask you
changed a
guys.
lot.
What was the natural progression of that?
Well, we really learned how to do a hysterectomy. I mean, you were doing hysterectomies all the time. I don't know if for you in particular starting in 2008, but certainly people now don't do any hysterectomies.
We still did a ton of open surgery because Onc was doing all of their, they weren't, only a
Oh,
fraction were
okay.
robotic. So we did a ton of vaginal hysts and robotic and TLHs, but mostly TLHs and abdominal and vaginal. But now they barely do any abdominal or vaginal. So everything
Right.
is on the robot. But I don't do that.
But there, even so, there aren't enough to really make sure that everyone's had enough to be able to go off and do it on their own when they finish residency.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I was a resident, there was one GYN surgeon who nobody really liked, who was doing laparoscopic tubal ligations. And that's when I sort of learned a little bit of laparoscopy, but I didn't really learn laparoscopy as a resident. I mean, anything I did was after I was already an attending, which was one of the things that was good about being in an academic place is that, there were people that, you didn't feel totally alone. There were people with different expertises that you could still learn from in a place like that. But when I was a resident, we didn't get an ultrasound on the labor floor till I was a chief resident. So I did not learn ultrasound when I was a resident. I did not learn laparoscopy when I was a resident. It was kind of like the dark ages. We managed to muddle through though. But one thing I was going to say is Einstein got a busier labor floor because people who maybe didn't have insurance or, weren't the type of patients who came before, they were like, wow, this is not a city hot. This is a nice hospital. Everybody come here. Jacoby like had less and less and less patients there. So, that was became much.
Also, at one point in the early late 80s, Jacoby's HIV rate was 2%, which doesn't sound like it's such a high number, but it was a high
Lot.
number.
That's a
And
lot.
so it was a lot. And I think that that also hurt the more middle class people that might have gone to Jacoby because the fear of AIDS and HIV was so extreme.
Wow. And did the crack epidemic affect
Oh,
you? What was that
there were
like?
lots of kind of drug addicts we knew. The heroin addicts were so different than the crack addicts.
Oh, tell me the difference.
Yes. Well, the crack babies were bad. But I'm not sure. I mean, crack, that was, well, no, it wasn't the 80s. It was in the 80s. The 80s was like kind of a bad decade, except for disco. If you like disco, 80s was a good decade.
I don't like disco.
No,
Well,
there you go.
the crack carried with it, even though heroin's a terrible drug and had a lot of sequelae in people's lives, the way the crack came in was extreme. And there were more, it was more extreme, it was more violent, it was more fractured. It didn't take a lot to get addicted to crack, and it doesn't cost a lot to try crack. And so it was going through communities. And the babies would be severely affected. And heroin addicts, on the whole, were kind of nice. I mean, they could have done terrible things to get the money for the heroin, but they weren't as violent, maybe.
Yeah, they weren't as violent. However, they did not have veins, and it was impossible to put IVs in. That was
Right.
tough. Yeah. Yes, I remember very distinctly July 1st of my internship, and I was in the ER at Jacoby because they sent interns to Jacoby in GYN. Although my second year, when I was a second year resident, they decided it probably wasn't so good sending interns. So second years had to go. So I had to spend 2 years as the primary call in the Jacoby ER. Not a fun thing. But July 1st. And so the third year is your backup, but my third year, who I won't name right here, right now, but was not really being particularly nice. And I was trying to put an IV in a heroin addict. Why didn't the nurses put IVs in? I
They
don't remember.
didn't.
They didn't. So, and the person was screaming at me that they wanted a real doctor. Like, what are you? And I was like, and thinking to myself, well, I'm not a real doctor. I started today. And I could not put an IV in this person. For I don't remember what happened after it. I just remember I was kind of traumatized. I went home thinking, I don't know what made me think I was a doctor, but I couldn't find a vein in this addict. So,
you know, I did not see that type of patient until I went to Stony Brook in
really
2016. And I saw so many heroin addicts in at Stony Brook. And in fact, the I was doing all of the late D&Es. And I remember this one woman similarly, she had, it was almost like someone took a pencil and or a pen and outlined her veins. They were all black. And in fact, when we went to the OR to do her D&E, she actually needed a PICC. It took 2 hours to get her IV access because she had used every single vessel in her body for drugs. And that was the first time that I'd seen that. But at Jacoby, one
You
of my
didn't
favorites,
see you didn't see
I
heroin
never
addict?
saw it ever. And at
Really?
Jacoby in the 2000s, my favorite story ever was as a an intern. You know, we had to the intern had to collect the stories from or the all the patients, and we had to come in and sort of present all of them at sign out, right? Whoever was lingering.
Yeah.
And so I went up to this woman, and I'm like, really fast, I'm trying to get everybody's history before sign out because I know they're going to get mad at me if I'm not there. And I was like, "What is she?" I said, "Ma'am, why are you here?" She said, "I'm high risk." And I was like, "Well, why are you high risk?" She goes, "I do cocaine." And I was like, "I broke my water." And I was like, "Okay." So she pre-prommed at like 28 weeks or something. She was high on cocaine. I remember her name. I'm not going to say it now, but it was, I remember her vividly. I remember her face, everything. And I went to the floor to like present her. And I was like, "Yeah, so there's this lady." And it was just like, it was just, you know, I was a baby, and it was just like a culture shock type of thing. And I'm high risk. I do cocaine. I was like, okay, nice.
But some of it, all of that craziness was part of why I loved residency.
Oh, it's the best.
I mean, I loved my career until the very end. And some of it is because every room was another short story.
Yeah.
Crazy
I
story.
Mean, you
tell
got
me your favorite.
Exposure.
Tell
If
me
you're
your
a
favorite
writer,
story, Nancy.
you're.
Tell me your favorite story.
I don't have a favorite story. And even my friends have said to me that I'm no longer doing this work and I'm not coming home with those good stories. I mean,
There must be something that stands out. Something.
Whether it was the patients or the staff. I mean, we had another staff that we haven't even gotten into yet from every religion, every race. Some of them were downright crazy, but they were raucous. And when everybody got together, it was an exposure that certainly my kids are not growing up with the diversity and the kind of exposure that I experienced
Yeah,
there.
I mean, it's
And
unparalleled.
I loved that. And people in my social life did not have that.
Right. They
And
lived
I think that's.
vicariously through your ruckus in.
Or I think it's one of the things that kept
interactions.
me there when I really think that Judy and I should have left in 2013 and gone off to Westchester with our nice patients. But we didn't.
We didn't.
Well, I'm
But
glad.
I'm
that
just
was good
saying.
for me.
Well,
There,
weren't you
it was an
resident by then?
excitement with
You were
all
an
this crazy.
attending, a resident.
I was an
I was an
attending, but
attending.
you
Yeah.
delivered my kids. So I'm glad you didn't
You could have
leave.
been a nice patient. You were a nice patient.
Right.
I was a nice patient.
Yes. I'm
Exactly.
just saying that wouldn't have
You're the kind of
excuse.
person that would have followed Judy to Lawrence, or
I
whoever
would
you didn't
not
go
have
to.
gone to Lawrence. Do you know
You
the
would have
type of
followed
group?
Judy. Forget
No,
about
you
it.
got. I came back from the Long Island to deliver my second, my VBAC. You know why? Number one, I had a no list, so I knew exactly who I did not want to touch me, and so that was the number one thing. And I feel bad for all other patients who have no idea who is should be on their no list. And
Right.
the other thing is, I was treated like gold. I had the nurses were giving me massages,
Yes.
Oh, I
Yeah.
feet and
remember
my
that. I remember
hands,
when you were
and
in labor
people.
with Charlie, everybody was so kind to you.
Oh my God, it
That
was
I remember
amazing.
that.
That's
I
the
remember
thing.
that.
When you're in a place where everybody knows you, I mean, you get special treatment, which is very, very nice. But I do have a story,
Okay, good.
which I can't remember what year, but I think it probably was in the 90s. When do you think they first started doing blood cord collection? Do you think in the
You mean
90s? For
umbilical cord?
umbilical cord blood
For
collection.
freezing?
Yeah.
Oh, it was definitely after like 91 when my first son was
Okay.
being born.
Okay. Oh, okay. So this was probably in the 90s. I had this lovely, lovely woman who had three children, and her third child had pretty sure leukemia. I'm not
Oh,
sure.
I remember this.
And she decided to have a fourth child just for the
Umbilical,
just for
yeah.
cord blood because she wanted to try to save her third child. And
Oh my.
so, and she wasn't that young. I mean, she was in her late 30s, but she already had three kids, whatever. And she, asked me to take out her IUD so she could get pregnant, and she got pregnant, and she had her child. And it was the first time I ever did a cord blood collection, and I was so nervous because you have to sign a bunch of things. It has to go in the ice, and it was being taken, I'm pretty sure, to Sloan Kettering because that's where her third child was getting taken care of. Anyway, so I was really nervous and whatever. We did all that, and then, I mean, P.S. the third child died. And I don't know if they could have ever even used the, because it's not a guarantee even for a sibling that it's going to be the right. But that child died, and then she eventually ended up having a fifth child.
Oh.
So, but I don't. Her name was Marianne. I don't remember her last name, but I remember what she looked like and the whole collection of the cord blood, and then that her child died anyway. And it was a young, it was like a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old or so.
Did she have, I mean, what was that conversation with her about doing that specifically?
Specifically getting pregnant.
Yeah, to save the other one.
Well,
I
I
mean, could she
mean,
understand
just,
there wasn't a guarantee?
yeah, I think so. Although, like a lot of new technology, even I'd have to say, for IVF, way back when, I think, when people, it starts getting publicized, people are way too like, oh, like you just do this and it works. So,
Yeah, but it
yeah.
was such an
And
easy thing to collect the blood that why not try it,
but it's not an easy thing to have a baby and go through a pregnancy and deliver, babies,
Yeah, but
they're
you love
risky.
your baby. I mean, she lucked
I
her.
understand that. I understand that. Yeah. So it was pretty heartbreaking.
When the women's group was dissolved, what was how did
Well, it didn't, in 2012, I remember
it's
this meeting so clearly.
slowly.
They wanted us to do more in-house call. And that's when we started doing in-house call in addition to our beeper call for faculty too.
Right.
And then when certain members decided they weren't going to come in when they were in a beeper call, they were going to just ask the in-house person to cover. And that's how faculty two ended. And I have to say, that's when I think my dissatisfaction grew and I started looking for ways to change my career.
Okay.
By 2013, I was trying to pull together a cancer survivorship program
I remember
because I
that.
was getting bored with low risk OBGYN and then doing these calls where you didn't necessarily know your patients and you weren't getting to deliver your patients, and our faculty two camaraderie wasn't there, and all the stuff that made it feel really good.
There was one other aspect, though, that I must say. So, yes, we had to do in-house call in addition to our beeper call, but then what happened was there were no young people who wanted to
Yeah.
do both. They were like, well, if I only have to be on 3 times a month, why would I want to be on like five or
You
six
see,
times a month? And,
but
you know.
I, yes, but I don't actually believe that's what happened because then there were people like Melissa finishing their residency. And if you had been able to join faculty two and we could have built it up so it was something that you would have loved it. So I
Right.
don't believe it's because of that. They didn't put the effort behind to find someone who would really fit in and get rid of people who didn't want to come in. They didn't support us. Anyway, I'm just saying, I think that what really happened is we didn't have the support. And once you do,
Well, but then there was that period of time. I mean, Jane worked with us, but she only wanted to do her in-house call, but she covered our patients. And there were a few other people
well, yeah,
who,
no, but
they.
2012 is when we had this meeting and we started taking on in-house call. And then it took up years before the whole thing just completely died. But it is, I do believe that if we had had the support of the administration, we would have found some young, dedicated person who wanted to do the extra because it felt good.
Swinging way back to the beginning, which I know was in December of 1996, because I had taken a leave of absence because my sister passed away, and but I came in, to which I schlepped my 6-year-old son, 5-year-old son, 6-year-old son, I think. I mean, that's when the women's group was born, actually. And he, I mean, we had been just part of faculty, of whatever the faculty practice at that point, which
Yeah, but
included
there were
many.
already two faculty practices at that point.
1990, well, there were, because there were also Montefiore
Yeah.
Medical Group people and
Yeah.
whatever.
Yeah.
But he at that point was willing to support it because people, women wanted to be with an all women's practice, so they knew that a woman provider would deliver them. And we were really excited. It was really
Can I ask you a
something.
question about that?
Yeah.
I struggle because right now where I am, the majority of the private practitioners are all older white men, straight white men. And I don't
No
find
women,
that shocking.
no
And I
women.
don't know, and I don't get it. I don't but and their patients want these men. They really, really want these men. And to the idea that there would be a young, capable woman that would deliver them instead is anathema to these patients. And I just don't get it. And I don't know if that's just a block in me where I wouldn't want a man delivering it.
There's no accounting for taste. No, listen. People are different. It's
Yeah.
very
But where does that come
unbelievable
from? What I where you must have
because things
thought.
haven't changed as much as we thought they would have changed by now.
I
And if
mean,
anything, things are going backwards that way.
it does seem very odd because when I started, I mean, I went to medical school in 1977. I mean, there weren't that many female OBGYN, so you had to. I mean, my mother, of course, went to male gynecologists in the 40s and 50s. So, I mean, those people, for instance, I mean, my mother raised me, so maybe my age person you would think would say, like, oh, well, all doctors are men, so whatever. But today, or even 10, 15 years ago, for women not to want to see a woman, or that just seems, it seems odd to me. There are some very good male gynecologists. I've met them in my life. I'm married to one. But overall, it was very funny. This is a little aside, and I don't know if you cut this out or not use names, whatever. But when my daughter was thinking about getting pregnant, and she lived in Long Island City, and I was trying to think of who to send her to, I happened to give her the name of a male who we knew who was working at NYU at that time. My daughter said to me, "A guy? Why would I go to a guy?" I mean, she had already seen multiple females that I knew, but they stopped doing OB and they were only doing GYN and they didn't take her insurance and this one what? And I told her a guy's name and she was like, so
Yeah, but I think we have seen that some of our hopes for things changing didn't change as much as we would have thought over the course of our lifetime.
right.
And that's in lots of fields.
The only way that I can, I've really tried to come to sort of try to figure this out because it really just does. I have situations and experiences at my current job that sort of make me think about this a lot. But it wasn't until after I had my children, one by section, one by VBAC, that I actually personally could understand a lot more about the pregnancy experience, the postpartum.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there was
Absolutely.
so much in
Totally.
postpartum that I was just shocked that no one said anything about,
Are you kidding? From
oh,
the second you peed on the stick?
is your
Yeah.
urine running down your leg because you can't make
Totally.
it to the bathroom? Nobody said that. Do you feel like you left your rectum in the labor room because it didn't follow you to the postpartum room? Nobody says that. Do you have horrible cramps that won't go away unless you take an oxy? Like people don't talk about it. And it wasn't.
How much it hurts to have a miscarriage at 8 weeks.
Horrible, right? And
You
the
knew
stuffing.
immediately, day 29, you knew you were pregnant by 8 or 8 weeks.
Yes,
If I had had a miscarriage, I
and you
would have been
get so
demolished.
jaded about it when
Yeah.
you're the person getting the call. Oh, the ER called again. This person had a miscarriage, and you roll your eyes and you're like, okay, let me just deal with it. But it's actually so profound and it sticks with people for the
Yes.
rest of their life. And it's
Yes.
something that you don't fully understand until you go through it. And so that brings me back to these men who go their entire careers not being able to fully understand the pain. The emotional
Yeah.
toll that these experiences take on the female, and that's what I think that's what I that the disconnect for me. That's the
Yeah.
disconnect, and I can't figure it out a little bit.
I do just have to say that I disagree with you a little bit about your statement about women wanting women to take care of them. I mean, I had a whole new outlook on pregnancy and labor and delivery after I had my two children. And there were things that I realized were stupid things I used to say to patients. And, you know, I had a whole new outlook, and that is true.
Yeah.
But I feel like a comment you made a way back at the beginning of our conversation, I'm not sure we were recording, about it's not the label, it's the wine, or something.
Oh, it's not the wine, it's the label.
Oh,
right,
the other way around.
Okay,
what does that mean? I wasn't in on that part.
Okay, it's, well, in any case, I feel
Schitt's
like
Creek. It's not, I like the wine, not the label.
So I feel like any good physician, not just OBGYN, but any good physician has to be a really empathetic, compassionate, good listener. And people of either gender, I think, can do that. And there are many things in life. Listen, my daughter-in-law just went to a neurosurgeon and she had surgery. I mean, the neurosurgeons probably never had neurosurgery. And the same thing for cardiothoracic surgeons. I mean, there may be plenty of doctors who have diabetes and then take care of diabetic patients. But I'm just saying, not everybody who does every type of specialty is going to be immediately intimately has intimate knowledge of that kind of process. And if you have a really empathetic person, I don't think it has to be a female. I don't.
Yeah, no. And I've met really incredible physicians that, you know, and OBGYNs that are male and straight men. And I just,
but they are the rarity.
They are. And I find that the misogyny is huge.
Yes. And the laughing at women,
or
the almost derision about a woman's pain.
And that's the part. And Judy, I hear you. I hear you loud and clear. Like, I don't want to make a blanket statement, you know, that men can't be good doctors, or you have to have the malady that you're treating. I don't think that wasn't my point. I think it's just, this is such a unique field where it's very intimate what you're doing. You're literally taking care of the private area of people, and then to not be compassionate and empathetic and sympathetic is interesting. And I find that you're right, Nancy. I've seen the derision, I've seen the misogyny.
Yeah,
it's,
and there are men who are, but, and there are women who don't.
Sure, absolutely,
without a doubt. But if you can make a generalization, men don't get it.
What
if you make a generalization, empathy is on the X chromosome.
What is more upsetting to me is why those type of people would want to go into OBGYN. You know, you would think that because it's such a delicate specialty for many reasons, the OB and the GYN, that you would hope that, you know, people who are empathetic and not the ones who really do not like women deep down, or that are not, listen, anybody who's a horrible person and not compassionate or empathetic, we would hope that they're either not doctors or they're, you know, radiologists or pathologists. But
that's the ideal.
Not the way life goes.
But I think the men, the generation ahead of us, it was a happy field. It was medicine. It was surgery. You made a lot of money. You didn't work like we worked. It was a better field for people of Dr. Lewis.
They worked harder. They worked harder than we worked. I mean, people.
No, but they got paid for it. They got,
we
hit a time. Yeah, no, I know. But I mean, it was a happy field. They got to use their hands. They made a lot of money. I think that it was a different field for people of Lewis and Oberlander's generation than ours.
Right.
I think Dr. Oberlander has the reputation of being one of those extraordinary physicians, right? No?
I love Dr. Oberlander. I have to say he's one of the two doctors I learned the most from during residency.
Wait, did he deliver your first one? Yes. Very smart.
Very smart. Very good teacher.
And
he would see 80 patients a day, literally.
What? You need
an
amazing
support
staff if you're going to do that. How do you?
Well, he did. I mean, it's, you know, he basically just came in for the laying of hands for 2 seconds, probably, and then on to the next patient. So
what about
every single minute of my labor, he was there every single minute.
Well, but you were a resident at the time? No,
I was a
ex-re-
fellow. I was a
okay.
fellow.
So
Yeah.
I mean, he knew you, you
Oh no,
know.
I know. I know. I know.
What about Dr.
I had a Me
Yeah.
Too experience with him. So,
Yeah.
yeah, when
He was.
I
I'm scratching my
he,
face for those of you who
yes,
can't see.
he, he, when I was a third year resident, I guess we were at a departmental dinner or something, and he kind of took me for a ride in his car to talk to me about joining his practice.
Kind of.
And, yeah, I got out of the car pretty quickly.
Oh my
So,
God.
yeah. So I didn't join his practice. I wouldn't have anyway, but I certainly didn't then. So yes,
But the one that really got.
he was one of those people who, you know, his wife would call the labor floor and say, you know,
Where is he?
can I talk to you? And we'd say, doctor, like, I'm not sure. Oh, we left for the hospital, you know, when, oh, maybe he's in the call room. We'll see if we can get him, you know. So.
But the one that was really egregious to me was Dr. who was one of the PIs on the Women's Health Initiative, was
Oy.
convicted
Oy.
of sexually abusing a patient under anesthesia in the IVF place in Dobbs Ferry. He was convicted, and he didn't touch his $400,000 a year salary.
What?
Well, he was.
Convicted.
Can't. No, I know. I'm just trying to think. He wasn't allowed to touch patients for a while, but somehow wasn't fired. Like,
Yeah.
I don't know what he was doing when he was
And
not.
he used to say comments to me all the time.
He was weird and creepy.
He was wearing creepy.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay, who was your favorite attending?
Katie
Ooh.
O'Hanlon.
Oh,
I
Katie
don't know
O'Hanlon.
her. Who is she?
Katie O'Hanlon was
An oncologist, a GYN
a GYN
oncologist.
oncologist who is one of the bestest, kindest people I've ever met in my life. She married her wife on Maria Shriver live in front of millions of people on 1990 on TV. She has sued multiple hospital centers, including Montefiore and Stanford, so that
Two,
her
yes.
partner would achieve benefits. Her partner is an heiress with gazillion dollars, but they wanted to make a point that gay people deserved. But she knew how to talk to a patient, and she taught me how to give bad news to a patient in a way that the patient did not feel abandoned and
She's
felt
great.
cared for.
Was
She
great.
was a good person.
I mean, her spouse, I don't know if she was a spouse at the time, but was the first person to get benefits from Montefiore,
Yeah.
who was a gay
Yeah.
couple, who were they were a
Yeah.
gay couple.
And Stanford, multiple centers that she
Yeah,
went on
because then she
from.
left and
Yeah.
went to Stanford. Well, when you say your favorite attending, I'm not sure, you know, if I think about from my residency, which was a long time ago. My mind really wants to think of a female, but we did not have female attendings. I mean, actually, Deli Fleischer. Did you know Deli, Nancy? Oh, he was great. He was an MFM,
Yeah.
who was very smart and very nice to patients, I thought. He didn't really so much primarily take care of you know, back then they read the NSTs and they did ultrasounds and whatever, but I liked him. All the other ones were just kind of interesting. Dr. Romney,
We wait, wait, we also Dr. Romney was
Dr.
kind, but
Romney
we
and
didn't
Dr.
have
Polia.
or
Ooh, I almost forgot.
But we didn't have organized teaching the way by the time you were a resident, there was organized teaching.
Yeah.
That was another thing that we saw come in. We would teach one-on-one, and the fourth year would teach the third year, the teacher, the second year would teach the first year, and the attending was almost incidental until at
You,
some point the
well,
attendant suddenly had to be there. But they
you
didn't from
hung a, you hung around with them. You were in the OR with them and saw what, you know.
But you
Well,
didn't
the other
necessarily do a delivery with them. You didn't call
no,
them for delivery.
because at
They didn't.
Einstein it was a private hospital, and so they didn't want residents in the room with them unless it was
But
a
even
sex
at
room.
Jacoby, if they were asleep, you wouldn't wake them up for delivery.
Well,
Only at the
that's the other thing
after
that
Libby Zion. When
when
was
I
Libby Zion?
started my residency, there was no attending in
Yeah.
house at Jacoby. The chief resident was the person, and
With the ability to take people to the OR without an attending.
right. And then by the time I was, and I think it just started when I was a chief resident, was the first year we had attendings in the house, which was good and bad for my psychological training, because I was the first one of my cohort. I mean, there was an attending in the house if I thought it would. Well, I mean, before that, the resident would call the attending in if it was a huge disaster, but they were pretty much expected to take care of any routine, anything,
Yeah.
whatever. But I mean, there was an attending in the house when I was a chief resident, so I kind of had that more, okay, there's somebody here, like I'm not, nobody's going to die because I have somebody to call because they're here. But yeah, you still sort of wanted to let them sleep, as Nancy said, but
You didn't call them. You wouldn't call them. It was a point of pride. You did not call them until it became a law that you had to call them. But I also remember being in the ER, which I kind of liked because it was a zoo, and you probably would have liked it because it was a zoo. And you would take a missed AB by yourself, transport up to the fifth floor treatment room by yourself, ask for Demerol and Phenergan from the nurse, who'd hand you syringes. You'd shoot the patient up. You'd do the whole D&C by yourself, and you'd leave the patient in the hallway. There would be no nurse. There'd be no. It was, I mean, it was. But the other side of it is, by the time I was an attending,
You're
I knew
very
how to responsibility.
right.
And when we hired in 2018 and whenever it was, we had those 10 brand new attendings all at once, they didn't know anything.
Right.
And so there is something with all this hours change that is infantilizing. I mean, we did cowboy medicine, but we also learned a lot.
I actually was going to ask you that, your perspective. Like now, they don't take responsibility for anything.
No,
And it's
no.
actually, I was saying at the last podcast that I'm on the hook. I've been a super chief for 15 years. I never
Yeah,
stopped being a super chief. You
yeah.
know, okay, I can walk away and stuff, but they can't do anything or make a decision without clearing it by me, you know,
Yeah.
or they don't know what to do, or, you know, and so it's not that the attending comes in for just the complication. The
Oh,
attending
no, Maddie,
there.
no. It was,
Yeah.
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 People, residents have been infantilized by regulation.
Right.
Well, I really, you realize, we all realize that these are byproducts of trying to make things safer, but they haven't really, I don't know that they've achieved that yet. So there has to be some better balance between people graduating from a four-year residency that can't really function by themselves
Wellness.
and wellness. Wait, and cowboy medicine, where they just left us on our own and, we took care of
I
everything.
mean, there's also but there's such a disconnect between the office and the hospital at this point that
Well, these residents aren't getting like legitimate outpatient
they're not.
experience. No, and so they leave and they spend 70% of their time, you know, at life after residency is 70% of the time in the office, right? And but their only experience is in the hospital. I mean, how do you, I
But
mean,
also, to get hospitalized nowadays, you have to be sick.
right.
And more is done as an outpatient. So even the hospital experience for someone that might like the whole continuity is not continuous.
Right.
No, there's lots going on that's wrong, and we're not about to fix it today. And I don't think we're fixing it in the next 4 years.
Don't think that's, we're not here to fix. We're here to
Survive.
reminisce and discuss.
I know, but it is disturbing to
I just
look at
need to
what's
get through
going
the
on.
next 3.5 years. That's
But seeing what's going on with Medicaid getting cut is disturbing.
very disturbing.
I wonder how it's going to pan out for Montefiore, because they're largely, I mean, 700, was it $750 million subsidy a year?
80% of
Without
their
that, how are
revenue.
they going to take care of their community? Isn't that the whole point of that hospital system, to take care of the community?
Yep.
Which makes it the most unique, like, hospital system in the country in a lot of ways, because I mean, the Bronx is so
Diverse,
it's diverse, but it's
poor,
not just
poor.
underserved. It's got so many social determinants of health. There's nothing on paper that adequately describes the Bronx patient.
No.
And you know, and so I tell people, like, no, this labor floor, this hospital was so challenging on so many levels that you're never going to adequately describe in words. It's all about your experience when you're there. And you know, even if you were to sort of list people's comorbidities and their traits, it doesn't do it justice at all, because every single person has all of it. And you know, and was
And we were
at another
seriously
hospital.
understaffed.
Correct.
Understaffed,
Understaffed and
under-resourced.
also
The
you
fact we didn't have a social worker in our
right.
department,
Wow.
I mean, it's
Yeah.
shocking.
Right.
And a psychiatrist to treat postpartum depression.
A psychiatrist who would take insurance.
Well,
Right.
to even get psych to see any of these patients was
Right.
impossible.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay,
Yeah.
the last thing I'm going to ask you, because we're going to probably wrap up shortly, actually. Well, I have so much to ask you, but for those of us who don't know, and this is not going to be relevant to anyone who didn't do residency at Einstein, how did you get through the renovation of the labor floor? I
Oh boy.
understand somebody died actually during that process.
My
Oh,
patient.
oh. So
Uh-oh.
can you, okay.
Uh-oh. There was
Can
a
you, this is a sore
lawsuit.
topic
There
here.
was
Is
a
it?
lawsuit.
Oh, is it? So I'm
Yeah.
just so curious because all of these labor floors are very antiquated and the hospitals are trying to upgrade them, right? But how you do that in a functioning, actively used floor is next to impossible. So I'm just curious, can you just tell me your.
I just, before we tell anything about that, the first renovation that I experienced there, they hired cheap architects because it's Montefiore. They didn't talk to any of us who work on the labor floor. They'd re renovate the whole labor floor. The woman's emergency call bell, if she's in the bed without a nurse in the room and needs an emergency, she'd have to get out of bed, walk over, and move the baby's bassinet to press the button next to the bassinet.
That was a good one.
Oh my
Yeah.
God.
So when they did the second renovation, they theoretically were more prepared and they moved triage up to seven, but they weren't prepared.
No, they weren't prepared. And trying to get stretchers downstairs if there was an emergency,
Pumps.
pumps, IV pumps. It was a
Yeah,
nightmare.
it was a nightmare.
The first renovation they did, right? I don't know if that was the first or the second when they put everything up on the seventh floor.
That was the second one.
That was
It
the
was
second.
like 2007-ish.
All right. When you came, Melissa, was it
Yeah.
already,
Yeah.
was it finished?
Yeah.
It was 2007. That's when she died.
What happened?
Okay.
Do you want
It
to
was a
talk about it?
31-year-old preeclampptia, but she came in with 236 of 136, and she was in triage for 6 hours without anything,
The
because they
problem
couldn't
was
find
because
pumps. They couldn't.
people, the labor
Yeah,
floor was on six and most people were on six, but
and it was completely
seven was
crowded.
like it was like a lifetime away. It was not, people were just not monitored correctly.
And there were no beds. It was a busy night.
So when I heard the story, when it was sort of told, there was something about the labs getting mixed up. There were two patients.
because the labs, the
Are you okay?
nurse couldn't get the nurse couldn't get the blood, so a resident got the blood, handed to the medical student to put the labels on. The medical student mixed up the labs,
Right,
and
right, right.
so the lab came back under a different patient at 44. And since everybody knew it wasn't the different patient, they had to repeat the lab. But honestly, I don't think that's why the patient died, because then they knew it was stacked and they got it within 20 minutes, and she was sectioned within that half an hour. And she had a brain bleed probably about 8 hours after the section stopped. And no one in the ICU seemed to pay attention to the fact she was having a brain bleed either. But basically, she had preeclampsia, and I just will say this. It was one of those Swiss cheese, Peter's Swiss cheese model of fuck ups. It was that. But as the I had to meet with the 15 people of her big Jamaican family who were very irate that the 31-year-old just died, the very smart neurologist who was helping me, because I didn't know how to talk to this family, went around the room and took the blood pressure. And nine of the 15 people who were yelling at me had to be sent down to the emergency room for emergency blood pressure control.
Oh my God.
Because it was, as much as we're not supposed to talk about racial differences in blood pressure, these were large
Hypertension.
Jamaican people who were undiagnosed blood high blood pressure, even though she didn't.
Why
But
did he do that?
because he was trying to make the point about blood pressure, no one would know about the blood pressure. You
Right.
don't know when your blood pressure's high. This girl did not have a history of high blood pressure. She
Right.
just came in out of the blue at
A term. I think she was a term.
she was 32 weeks. She was 31 years old and
Wow.
at 32 weeks.
I'm so sorry that happened. That
It was a
definitely
horrible
stays
story. That
with
was
you.
horrible. Yeah.
So, I just want to say thank you guys so much. This was actually
It was
really
so nice to chat
fascinating.
with you.
Yes, it was. This was
Absolutely. I don't
fun.
know if you can hear the construction going on in my house, but
She's renovating her house. She's renovating.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So
There's
things
a lot.
have really turned around for
Yeah.
you.
Yeah, really. Really good.
Now